KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. A new study ties lack of sleep to weight gain, but losing weight may not be as easy as getting your 8 hours. We're going to find out more ahead. Also, Dave Beck reveals why composer Richard Wagner played music at Coney Island. Who knew? The New York Times bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, told the story of a young woman who died from an aggressive cervical cancer. It also documented her amazingly immortal cells, which have been reproducing since 1951. Now a University of Washington study has pieced together what caused Henrietta Lacks' cancer, but more than that, it has entered into an agreement with the Lacks family for the first time since her cells went under study. Jay Schendere is an associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington. He's senior author of that study, and welcome to our studios. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I had a very brief introduction of Henrietta Lacks. Maybe you can explain a bit more who this woman was.
Sure. So Henrietta Lacks was a woman from the South, the American South, who in 1951 was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And was treated at Johns Hopkins University, where she passed away that same year. Her cells from her cervical cancer were used by scientists at Johns Hopkins right before her death to establish the first immortalized cells, the first immortalized human cells. And that cell line, known as HeLa, has been used in countless publications and or countless research directions over the last 50 years. Everything from helping develop the polio vaccine, having the cells sent into space, and no shortage of other endeavors.
So when you say immortal, what is, I mean, in my brain, that means they never die. That can't be true.
So most cells, when you try to grow them outside of the context of a human body, or at least at the time these experiments were first tried, would only divide a few times and then they would die. It had been shown a few years before that under specific conditions, you could get mouse cells to essentially grow forever, to continue reproducing without ever dying off. And the HeLa cells had the same property of essentially continuing to grow. So these cells have been continuously passaged for decades, and in particular, they proliferated at a rate that was very fast, so doubling every 24 hours or so, and as such, were widely used.
Do we know why her cells were so prolific and so and immortal?
Well, so I think one of the insights of our study, or one of the things that we think we might have more insight into now, is potential reasons for why that might be the case. So cervical cancer is overwhelmingly caused by a virus, human papillomavirus, and in some instances, the genome of the virus actually inserts itself into the genome of the cells in the cervix and thereby giving promoting cellular growth and, mm-hmm. and giving rise to a cancer. And it was known that HPV, this virus, was present in the genome of HeLa. What we were able to show is where and how the genome of the virus inserted into her genome. And as it turns out, it did so in a very complicated way, in which it was essentially scrambled and amplified. And moreover, the precise location at which it inserted allowed it to loop to another cancer, a human gene that can be a cancer gene, and activate it. And so we think that might be part of what explains the particular aggressiveness of her cancer.
And the immortality of her cells.
Exactly.
The same thing. We'll talk a little bit more about your research in a second. One other thing that we didn't say about Henrietta Lacks and her amazing genes is that this research, like a lot of research that was done on not only poor people, but poor African-American people in the mid-20th century, was done without her knowledge or her family's knowledge.
That is correct. So to the best of anyone's knowledge, I think she was not made aware at the time that her cells were being taken or told about what that would be done with them. And the standards at that time were very different than today, right? So there were no explicit rules governing patient consent at that time the way there are that were put in place decades after.
Now, another thing besides the science of your study that is groundbreaking is the fact that, as I understand it, this is the first study that's been published with the explicit permission of Henrietta Lacks' descendants. Right?
Yes. So over the past several months, the NIH, and in particular, Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, and Kathy Hudson, who directs outreach and public policy, have been having an extended conversation with the Lacks family, her descendants, to try and assess their views on her genome and what sort of protections need to be put in place around it. And I think came to what is a very reasonable agreement about how to manage this. And our paper is the first paper that includes an acknowledgement of the contributions of Henrietta Lacks and her family to biomedical science. And moreover, the data that we generated will be placed in a controlled repository where the family will participate in conversations about how the data is used.
And your study is, subject isn't the right verb, but you fall under this agreement because you receive funding from the National Institutes of Health to do your research.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct.
So did they come to you and say, hey, we really think it's time to inform the people who are related to this genome that we're doing this research? What did they say?
So things happened very quickly a few months ago. So around March, around the time that our paper was accepted at Nature, and we were actually exploring ways of potentially trying to reach out to the family. It was unclear how to do that exactly. A competing paper came out from a different group in Germany that was published in the journal G3. And that sparked through the when the family found out, they were upset about it. And Rebecca Skloot, the author of the book, published an editorial in the New York Times, and the German authors quickly withdrew the data. The NIH was aware of our study at that time and saw this as an opportunity to set things right. And so Nature and we agreed to hold the paper until there's a chance for this extended discussion to happen.
So when we talk about your findings, and you said countless, I think the last number I saw was like more than 70,000 different studies have been published based on research into these HeLa cells. Is it sort of, I was trying to find an analogy, like the NSA tapping your phone line and publishing information about you when you publish information about somebody's genome anonymously?
So it's complicated, right? So I think there has been this idea that we can guarantee anonymity in genomic data, and that is clearly a problematic assumption. There are all kinds of anecdotes about people identifying who is associated with a particular genome based on a constellation of information, adopted children identifying their birth parents and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So I think there needs to be within science, but a conversation that also involves the broader community, a discussion about how to approach, what can we promise patients as far as their privacy when we ask for their samples and their genomes for our research. So much of human genetics over the next decade is going to depend on the participation of the public and on probably hundreds of thousands of people with disease in these sorts of studies. And if we don't have the sort of mutual trust, I think, that we tried to build here with the Lacks family, I think it's going to be really hard.
We're talking with Jay Chenderay, who's an associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington. Let's talk about the science. It's complicated, but as I understand it, in addition to what you found out about the intersection of the HPV and Henrietta Lacks cervical cancer, it's how you sequence the genes that's unique. It's a new way forward in genome studies, right?
Yeah. So if you think about your genome or my genome or Henrietta Lacks' genome or the HeLa genome, really every genome, human genome, is really two genomes. It's the genome you got from your mom and the genome you got from your dad. And every location in the human genome, you have got two copies residing on two different chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the limitations of current technology is that when we find differences between you and me, we can't tell whether those differences reside on the copy you got from mom or the copy you got from dad. And so one of the things that we're able to do now with these new methods that we've been developing is to separate out those contributions. And that in turn gives us an added level of resolution in looking at cancer genomes for these complex changes.
Would it give you information about inherited traits, for example, in a way that you might not? And for example, if colon cancer were in your family, you could determine, oh, it's coming down through the father's line if you can separate the father from the mother?
Yes. There are some types of genetic diseases where the separation of information, what's called haplotypes, can be important for that very sort of thing.
So this is the fine. You can find out more. You can probably go to our website, and there's a link to this study because this is as much science, unless scientists really want to know. Maybe they can contact you as well or read the article in the journal Nature. Where do you go now with this research? What's next for your lab?
So our lab is really interested in developing technologies in and around genetics and genomics. So one of the nice things I think about this genome is that we've completed it to a very high standard of completion and accuracy and so on and so forth. And so I think there's an opportunity here to do this on additional cancers and maybe get insights into mechanisms that might not result from standard methods. Many of the things that we found that we've talked about here were surprises to us. We did not go into the study expecting to find them. And so the next one we do might be equally interesting.
Jay Shendure is an associate professor of genome sciences at the University of Washington. He's senior author of a study looking into the causes of Henrietta Lacks' cancer, and it, as you've just heard, inadvertently they found out new ways of sequencing genes that divide the mother's genome and the father's genome, and that leads to all sorts of new information, I'm sure, in the future. This is the first study done under new regulations for use and documentation of the HeLa cells, descendants of cells originally taken from Henrietta Lacks' body. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:20. Award-winning local cartoonist Ellen Forney talks about her art and her journey with bipolar disorder in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Shack Art Center present Fresh Paint, Festival of Artists, at Work at the Everett Marina on August 17th and 18th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
61 degrees in Seattle. We've got some clouds in the sky, but the forecast says those are going to go away. It's going to be sunny this afternoon with a high of 83. Tomorrow, a similar story. Clouds in the morning, sun in the afternoon with a high of 80. There appears to be a connection between not getting enough sleep and gaining weight. We'll look into that just after 9:30.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. 16 years ago, award-winning cartoonist Ellen Forney was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. In her recent graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me, Forney examines that period of her life. She was worried about how drug treatments for her disease would impact her creativity. I spoke to Ellen just after her book's publication. I asked her to talk about her original diagnosis.
I was seeing a therapist, but a social worker, for, I guess, maybe a few months. I was seeing her when I was feeling down. And then a few months later, I was getting more and more up. And she called it jazzed. I was calling it manic-y, which mm-hmm. was, again, you know, a word that I had been using for a while. There again, I think that there was some unconscious or subconscious idea of maybe what was going on. And she referred me to a psychiatrist. And, you know, I don't remember how I was, what I was thinking then when I was like, when I went to the psychiatrist, what I thought she might say or why it was that I was going there. But I know it was pretty quickly. I think the second visit that she told me that I was bipolar, and I didn't believe it for a moment. And then we went through the symptoms together, and it just dawned on me as we went through it that that was me.
The drawing of you, Ellen, in that state, you're literally starry-eyed. It's this happy sort of incandescent creature with these kind of spit curls. Mm-hmm. Maybe you had little spit curls at
the time. I did.
And these, you draw yourself just almost as if you're going to leap through the page.
Mm-hmm.
As a reader, you get the sense of how you must have felt electric at that time. Not in a bad way necessarily.
Well, I think as a cartoonist and in a graphic memoir, I had some tools that were very particular to comics. So in the different mood states, I used a different rendering style. So like you were just saying about when I was manic, it was very like starry and loopy and big and loose. And then when I moved into depression, the way that I depict that is a lot more stark. It's a lot more kind of heavy. And then, you know, I go through various ways that I was up and down and upset and confused or overwhelmed or happy, you know, and in different styles, including photographs of my sketchbooks. So just a way to kind of touch back in on that it's a real story, and it's, here's something archival.
You kept a journal, a sketchbook, and a written sort of set of lists because you were watching yourself a lot. That, I think, was an assignment from your psychiatrist, as well as maybe something you did yourself.
Yeah, that was both. I had a lot of material to, you know, refer to when I was doing Marbles. I had actually a stack of journals. So it was writing. It was just tons of writing about just what I needed to get out, and then drawings in those journals as well. And those clips of those or little excerpts of those are in Marbles as well. And then also sketchbooks. And I picked out some from when I was really depressed, just needed to get down some of those demons, I guess, onto paper. And then also some drawings from when I was manic and just loopy and just like whatever was coming down on the paper.
Maybe we should take a step back for listeners who don't really know what bipolar disorder is. Some people might know bipolar disorder under the term that we use to refer to it by, which is manic depression.
Mm-hmm.
Although
bipolar disorder is kind of the day. I asked in the process of doing this book, I had a psychiatrist that, not my own psychiatrist, that I was in touch with to run things by him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, so what is the usual dosage for this medication or things like that? And asked him, is there a difference between manic depression and bipolar disorder? And he said, no, that it's just basically the style of the day. Like,
so now we call it bipolar disorder.
Exactly. Yeah.
But essentially, it's a disorder that involves cycling between two states of being. One is sort of manic euphoria, and the other one is debilitating depression.
Right. Although really it manifests itself differently in different people. So, for example, for me, mania was really euphoric. At the same time, it was really this sense of being pulled and compelled, so it wasn't all just a joy. Mm. And for some people, it's being really irritable or really angry. So it just, it's like a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy that we would experience as sort of beyond our control, right? And then depression would be kind of the same experience that's very common to a lot of people that have depression, even if they don't have bipolar disorder. Which is feeling really, not just feeling really low, but feeling really low that doesn't feel attached to any sort of grieving. And it's this weird, prickly low.
And I'm holding up the book, which of course nobody can see because this is radio. But I think that this particular full page illustration really says how I feel personally when I'm depressed, when I'm in a state like that, which is there's a lump, which is you, who finally manages to pull herself through a door. I mean, that's it. That took everything that you had, and then you're back in
lying down on the couch under the blanket.
Did you draw this at the time or in retrospect when you're putting the book together?
I drew this in retrospect. And there again, just to point out the drawing style,
yes.
I used a really, really simple style there. So it's me, but it's just this general idea of what it was like. So for me, at different times, for other people, probably it's about the same amount of detail as like a restroom sign, right? So
yeah.
So that was a general experience of what I called cocooning. I think we all often, or many of us, have even names for these different mood states. It becomes this thing that almost feels outside of you. It's inside of you, but it surrounds you to that kind of degree that becomes its own character in a way.
There's the whole way you feel. That's one big thread through the book. But another, which you latched onto, I think, almost immediately, or at least in this book, which is the connection between what you call your manic states, or those states of euphoria, and your artistic creativity.
Being an artist is so much a part of my core that when I was first diagnosed, the idea of taking medications and the possibility that might flatten my creativity was terrifying. And so at that point, I decided that I was not going to take medications. It's one of the points in my book that I examine really throughout the entire book, what that has meant to me as an artist throughout all my mood states and different treatments. And that's why I bring in the different artists and writers through history that have had mood disorders and little bios of them, and then the studies that are about creativity, what it is, and correlating mood disorders and creativity, like I talk about in why it was important to me to keep my sketchbooks when I was depressed. It was a way to get this tangled, difficult to understand parts of me and sort of whirling around my head down on paper. And so this was like an enormous version of that, going through all of this onto paper.
Seeing the book and talking to you right now, it's tied to something that's in the book on a more personal level. Obviously, that notion of coming out with bipolar disorder to people that you knew, including your family, a big section about that, your friends, the reactions of your friends. This is coming out on a much more public scale than talking to your mother.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is.
And so I wonder, in putting together that proposal, how scary is something like that? I mean, it's different than talking about sexuality. Or maybe it's not different. I don't know.
Well, it is. I think that sexuality is, in my experience, kind of a joy to put out there. And it's something that you can be, you know, like cheeky or brave. And it's a really different kind of brave, I guess. This is a different kind of brave.
Yeah.
When I was putting the book together, in particular in the beginning, I have to say I wasn't thinking nearly so much about what it was going to be like at the point where I'm at right now of putting the book out there. That sank in over the course of probably the penciling and inking. I mean, to a degree, when I was, you know, like mapping out the story and what is it that I'm comfortable sharing or at least can share, right? There were some things that, you know, I kept private, believe it or not. It's kind of a
there's a lot of yes,
I know there's a lot of exposing myself, but in a way I think allowing yourself to be vulnerable that way and to just put it out there, it makes me feel stronger.
That's cartoonist Ellen Forney. Her graphic memoir is called Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me. We originally spoke last winter. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Nine 31. A look at the connection between sleep deprivation and weight gain in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Blue Jasmine, a new film written and directed by Woody Allen, shot in San Francisco. Starring Cate Blanchett, Sally Hawkins, and Michael Stuhlbarg. Starts Friday.
62 degrees in Seattle. The morning clouds are beginning to give way to sun, and we expect to hit a high this afternoon of 83. 9:32, I'm Bernard Ouellette. KUOW's Dave Beck has the story of how Wagner's music was introduced to America, 15 minutes from now.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. What does sleep have to do with body weight? Well, it turns out quite a bit. A new study shows people who don't get enough sleep every night have a tendency to crave fats and sugars and thus a greater likelihood to gain weight. Plus, the study also shows that when we're sleep deprived, we don't always make good choices. Matthew Walker co-authored that study. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Professor, we've heard before that a lack of sleep can cause weight gain. What specifically did you and your lab set out to study?
Yes, so we've known for some time at the population level in terms of epidemiological evidence that there is a link between getting insufficient sleep and developing weight problems and obesity. And we've also known some about the changes within the body in terms of hormones for appetite and how they change with a lack of sleep. But what we haven't fully understood is what's going on within the brain, what's changing within the brain that could lead to these types of differences in appetite or food choices and hence developing weight gain and obesity. And that's really what we were targeting here in this study.
So how did you go about looking into how people's brains changed?
So what we did in the study was take a group of healthy adults, and we ran them through two different sessions of an experiment. In one of those sessions, they had a full night of sleep, a full eight-hour opportunity. While in the other session, we actually sleep-deprived them for a night. And then the next morning, in both of those circumstances, we placed them inside an MRI scanner so we could look at their brain activity. And we had them make choices about foods that they desired. So we were showing them lots and lots of different foods inside the MRI scanner. And those foods ranged in a gradient from being healthy to unhealthy, high calorie, low calorie. And so we could see what was changing within the brain in terms of its activity in response to these desirable food items.
So people who have less sleep chose, as I mentioned earlier, sort of fatty, sugary items, and people who had a full night's sleep were less likely to choose those items?
That's correct, yes. So these were the same people in both of those two conditions. So each person acts as their own control, which is helpful. And that's exactly what we found. We found that people, when they were sleep-deprived, compared to when they had a good night of sleep, firstly, they started to desire food items that had higher calorie values. So they started to select things like ice cream, pizza, donuts, etc. And I should note, by the way, that the participants were actually given some of these foods at the end of the MRI scan that they chose. So it really forced them to make their choices appropriately and not just based on what they think that fashionably they should be choosing.
Huh.
But what was also interesting was what was going on in the brain that we believe could actually provide an answer to what they were doing there and that shift in their choices. Because two things actually changed in very different ways in the brain. We found that deep centers within the brain that control primal motivations and desires, those parts of the brain, when you were sleep deprived, ramped up in their activity in response to desirable foods. However, regions higher up in the brain, in a part of the brain that we call the frontal lobe, and you can think of the frontal lobe almost like the CEO of the brain. It's very good at making complex, high-level, rational judgments and decisions. Parts of that area of the brain were actually impaired by sleep deprivation. And so this sort of double hit in terms of abnormal brain activity, we believe, offers a cogent explanation for exactly why people start to make maladaptive and inappropriate food choices that can lead to weight gain without sufficient sleep.
I read one observer actually compare sleeping to rebooting your computer.
Yes, so I think if there's a silver lining here, it's sort of the opposite side of the deprivation coin, which is to say that when you're getting a good night of sleep, that sufficient sleep may actually beneficially reset the circuits within the brain and push you towards making more optimal food choices that won't lead to weight gain, that will lead to weight control. And so I think we're understanding not just the bad that happens when you don't get sleep, but also the good that happens when you do get sleep and exactly how that mechanism works when we do get good sleep.
So the findings are fascinating about what about how our brain chemistry, how our brain actually changes with sleep and without sleep. But this doesn't sound like a prescription for weight loss itself.
No, of course. I think what this does suggest is that sleep is perhaps an underappreciated factor, and it's just one factor that does contribute to weight control. That, amongst many other factors, of course, controlling exercise and diet as well, all of these things, I think, together will lead to a more healthy lifestyle in terms of weight control.
Will your lab continue to focus on the impact of sleep deprivation on things like weight gain and other brain changes? Is that your primary focus?
It will be, certainly. In the future, we look at a whole variety of different functions that sleep supports. We know that now from work that we and others have done, that sleep is not just important for metabolic control and weight control. It critically helps with things like learning and memory, emotional regulation, and mental health. So all of these factors we'll continue to explore, including this one, looking at weight gain and control. And I think what's going to be interesting there is to ask, how is the impact of sleep different for people of different body weights? Are some people even more vulnerable to the impact of sleep deprivation than others? And is that dependent on their current health status? So all of these things that we need to know for good medical and public health policy.
And just a last question, and I bet a lot of people, in addition to myself, are wondering how much sleep is enough sleep?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer specifically. It's a little bit like saying, well, how many calories do I need each day? It's different for different people depending on their physiology. But certainly, as with calories, we could say about 2,000 is good for your average human being. Somewhere between 7.5 to 8 hours of sleep is a solid recommendation for most adults. What we know is that when people start to get less than 7 hours of sleep, we can start to observe very easily changes in terms of their brain function and their performance in the laboratory.
I'm glad I can explain all these problems by my lack of sleep. Matthew Walker, and this is, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're very well.
Matthew Walker is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of California, Berkeley. He's co-author of a new study that links sleep deprivation to weight gain and explains a little bit about how our brains actually change when we don't get enough sleep. So everybody, go to bed. I'm ready for a nap. This is Weekday. From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This month, opera lovers from around the world will flock to Macaw Hall in Seattle to take in Seattle Opera's internationally acclaimed production of Richard Wagner's Ring of the Nibelungen, easier to say the Ring Cycle. But before this, before grand opera, where did a music lover go, say, in the 1890s, if you wanted to take in some world-class Wagner? Well, if you lived in Europe, you probably had it easy. But here in the United States, would you believe, Coney Island? KUOW's Dave Beck is here. And seriously, Dave, this, I think Coney Island, and I think of cotton candy. I think of sea air. I think of maybe, you know, rides and things like that.
The parachute jump, yes.
Nathan's Hot Dogs, hot dog eating contest. But really, Wagner?
Yeah. Well, to explain this,
please,
a little backdrop. You know, the story of classical music in America and cultural institutions like the Seattle Symphony or the Ladies Musical Club here in town had to do with these women's clubs. I mean, women were great supporters of great music. And there was a woman in Brooklyn, New York, who was a newspaper editor of the Daily Eagle there. Her name was Laura Langford.
Mm-hmm.
And she got to know this character in New York who actually was kind of Richard Wagner's surrogate son, right-hand man, a guy by the name of Anton Seidel, who had come from Europe to lead the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic. And he was a great Wagnerian, and he was introducing Wagner to New York. So this club, sort of cult-like, formed around Anton Seidel, and it was called the Seidel Society. And
wow.
Laura Langford would get these trainloads of women and children, and she made sure that they had low-priced tickets to go see these Wagner concerts on Coney Island in an open air pavilion.
So he was attached to the Metropolitan Opera in Manhattan, but he and his music would travel out to Coney Island in a sort of Johnny Appleseed way.
Exactly. He was performing all over New York because Wagner and he was a great new music champion.
Mm.
And he wanted new stuff to be heard. And Wagner just really resonated with everyone, but particularly with women like Laura Langford, who were interested in the strong, you know, female characters in Wagner and you know, getting this stuff out there.
Now, Dave, you are our cellist in residence. You are a musician, so you knew all about Laura Langford probably, but I've never heard of her.
No, I mean, it's only been, I'd say, in the last 5 years. I met this gentleman. I've been reading the books of Joseph Horowitz, a great Wagner scholar and social historian, and he wrote a book called Wagner Nights, and it really lays out this story of Laura Langford, of the Coney Island concerts, of Seidel. It's a really rich and interesting period that people who are very knowledgeable about music don't really know this aspect of American musical history, and it's very closely tied to Wagner. And in New York in the 1880s and 90s, you arguably heard the best Wagner performances in the world, even beyond Europe, because you had Wagner's right-hand man, Anton Seidel, in America making this happen.
So you got a chance to talk to Joseph Horowitz, right?
I did, and he explained to me how he came to discover Laura Langford in the first place.
I went to the Brooklyn Historical Society looking for material on Anton Seidel because I was writing a book which was mainly about Seidel and his advocacy of Wagner and Wagnerism in the 1880s and 1890s in New York, and I knew he was in Brooklyn, and I discovered an archive for the Seidel Society, and in the process discovered the Seidel Society, which was a women's club, unlike any other, founded by a woman named Laura Langford. And this women's club eventually became the major presenter of music in Brooklyn, which is to say Laura Langford was a nationally significant impresario, although completely forgotten, who in the summer presented Seidel and his orchestra 14 times a week at Coney Island, twice a day. And in the winter and in the spring, less frequently, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. She was a journalist. I'm interested a little bit in her background because she had family connections and actually spent some time in the White House.
She was from Tennessee and was an old friend of Andrew Johnson when he was the governor of Tennessee. Through her family, she knew Johnson. She did spend some time in the Johnson White House. She did write a book about the first ladies of the White House, which is what made her name after she moved north after the Civil War and settled in Brooklyn. She became known as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
She was also a clairvoyant. She was a theosophist. She knew Madame Blavatsky. She is a seeker. She was a woman always in search of herself and some purpose in life, and she mainly found it for a period of time through Anton Seidel and Wagner. When Seidel died in 1898, she was disempowered, and she disappears from the historical record. Mm-hmm. But during the years that Seidel was in New York, and Seidel, by the way, considered moving to Brooklyn, she was empowered by Wagner, and she was a major cultural figure.
Mm-hmm. How did she come across Anton Seidel? How did she meet him? And
Everybody knew who Anton Seidel was. He was by far the dominant force in classical music in New York, beginning in 1894, 95, when he first arrived to take over the Metropolitan Opera, which in those years was a German house.
Mm-hmm.
And Seidel was already, he was 35, famous in Europe, and a protege, a direct protege of Wagner, somebody who lived in Wagner's household as a young man.
Mm-hmm.
He galvanized musical New York. He was instantly famous, charismatic. So how she personally became acquainted with him, I don't know, but he was not a hard person to meet, because in those days, people weren't hard to meet. And he was at Fleischmann's restaurant every day at the round table with Dvorak, smoking his cigars and watching Dvorak drinking his many beers.
Right.
So it would have been a simple thing for her to meet him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so she's working at the Brooklyn newspaper. Probably.
The Daily Eagle.
Yeah, probably when, I mean, that could have been one way that
she's... Well, what happened in more detail is that Seidel was hired by the resort, Brighton Beach on Coney Island, to conduct an orchestra that would counteract Patrick Gilmore's band down the island at Manhattan Beach, which was drawing everybody to Manhattan Beach. And the Brighton Beach Railroad, which ran this resort hotel in Brighton Beach, tried to get a famous band from Britain or France, and they failed. So they did something wholly implausible. They hired Anton Seidel in his orchestra, and nobody came. This was noticed by Mrs. Langford, and it was Mrs. Langford, in order to preserve this unlikely adventure in cultural programming, she organized trainloads of women to attend the Seidel Society concerts at Brighton Beach in order to keep them going. And eventually the Seidel Society took the concerts over, became the presenting organization.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in these concerts that Seidel conducted and that she had a hand in, because, as you mentioned, there's the Gilmore Band playing there.
Right.
Much more populist and
right.
things that, you know, you could take the right. family to. But she and Seidel, in some combination, cooked up this idea that we're going to present Wagner opera excerpts.
Yeah. Well, Seidel's concerts at Brighton Beach were what we might call pop concerts. However, by far the composer most performed was Wagner, and Wagner was very popular. So the Wagner nights, when there was nothing but Wagner on the program, would sell out this 3,000-seat music pavilion on the water, and they did include a lot of singing. They were not, you know, operatic acts, but you might hear very often the Liebestod sung by a soprano with orchestra. This was considered very popular programming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And, I mean, what do you know about the atmosphere of these concerts where people are listening to Wagner?
Oh, we know everything about the atmosphere of these concerts. They were copiously described. The atmosphere is religious. Nobody coughed. I mean, if you didn't behave, you were expelled. And the ushers were members of the Seidel Society with badges that said S. There was a separate section at the very back for smokers. But the decorum of these concerts was religious.
Mm-hmm. The concerts at Coney Island?
At Coney Island, yes.
Wow. But that was also an offshoot of what was going on in the city. I mean, there was
also
this...
religious.
Yeah.
Yes, the Metropolitan Opera during these years was a Wagner shrine. It was, I think, the peak period by far in the history of the Met. Others may disagree. But for seven seasons, everything was given in German, whether it was Aida or Die Walküre. Most of the repertoire was Wagner. The principal conductor was Anton Seidel. And the Met housed probably the greatest ensemble of German singers in the world. The principal soprano was Lili Lehmann. The tenors included Albert Niemann. This was the prime Wagner ensemble in the world. There was nothing even in Germany to match it.
Mm-hmm. And
did Zeidel primarily create that atmosphere with his?
Yeah, Zeidel was a galvanizing, charismatic force. Everybody was instantly seduced and submissive. He was a very great figure.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, too, in some of the exchanges that you document between Laura Langford, this journalist who became such a great Wagnerian, and Zeidel himself, because they complemented one another in interesting ways.
Well, what's fascinating is the authority that she wielded. She's really running the show. They work together hand in glove. She tells him how much money we've got for the concert. He says, okay, let's do this and this. She might say, well, Maud Powell's not available. Who else could we get? So they have very pithy exchanges documented in the letters of the Zeidel Society, mm-hmm. in which the two of them by themselves are programming an enormous number of concerts at a very inexpensive cost. And she insisted on ticket prices that were very low.
Mm-hmm.
There was not much in the way of a subsidy. So they functioned very economically. Imagine an orchestra of 50-some-odd players playing 14 times a week with minimal rehearsal.
Yeah. And part of these presentations at Coney Island, maybe elsewhere, had a commentary from, you know, prominent journalists and excerpts. And there was a real attempt to give meanings to these authors, yeah. to help people understand what was happening.
These people are missionaries. So Langford Society frequently sponsored lectures. Say Henry Crabill might lecture on Parsifal and the Christ story or some such topic.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the lectures were about women's suffrage mm-hmm. or theosophy. This was a full-service club, the Zeidel Society. And one of the novelties was that one summer she announced that she would be giving Wagner lectures written by Zeidel with live orchestral excerpts. And she said, the Zeidel Society said, this is the first time that this has ever been done, and it may have been. So she, a woman, and this was questioned, in an outdoor 3,000-seat music pavilion, delivered in English these lectures that had been written in German, and the orchestra and Anton Zeidel performed excerpts illustrating the lectures.
Music of Richard Wagner and Joseph Horowitz talked to Dave Beck. His books include Wagner Nights and the latest Moral Fire, about the missionary zeal that Laura Langford and the women of late 19th century New York had for Wagner. And Dave, there are thousands of people outside at Coney Island listening to a full orchestra, and I couldn't help but think a little bit about the Seattle Opera ring cycle, because it really, any ring cycle produced around the world evokes this sort of pilgrimage
yes.
experience. And I know that there are people from all over the country and all around the world in Seattle through the month of August every 4 years to pay homage to arguably Wagner's greatest work, the four opera epic ring mm-hmm. cycle.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm curious, because you've covered this, Marcy, potential, you know, change in leadership at Seattle Opera, and tell me what's happening there and what that means.
Right. This is the last ring cycle for 30-year opera general director Spate Jenkins. He announced his retirement about a year ago. The opera recently announced that they were replacing Spate, as we all call him Spate, nobody calls him Jenkins, with a wonderful British younger man named Aidan Lang. He's been directing Opera New Zealand, and he's full of energy. He's a stage director, unlike Spate Jenkins. He has directed a production of The Ring in Latin America, and I know he flew in to see this production, and nobody who's involved with Seattle Opera's Ring Cycle would tell me definitively that this is the end of the so-called Green Ring production,
mm-hmm.
which is in its third and a half production. The first two operas had an early debut, and then they've done this Ring subsequently three full times over 12 years.
Yeah, and it's a hard thing to contemplate Seattle without a Ring cycle because it goes back to the mid-70s. I was growing up here and listening to and hearing on KUW back in those days the Glenn Ross Ring cycle. So that legacy and where it how it goes forward is an interesting question.
Well, it's a fascinating thing, and I don't know anything about ticket availability for this current Ring production, but if you're interested ever in a cross between the soap opera Dallas and really beautiful music, hie yourself down to McCall Hall, because we don't have 3,000 open air seats, but we've got a whole lot of seats in McCall Hall.
Yeah, but it's like being outdoors in this production because the green ring.
Yes, just like
you're in an old growth forest someplace with flying horses.
Flying horses and fire. Dave Beck, always great to have you here.
Nice to be able to do this, Marcy.
And now, the sound of the day. Okay, it sounds like dogs, but in fact, that is the sound of seven chimpanzees food grunting and food squeaking because lunch is being served. Sounds like it's something really tasty. I'm not sure what they give chimpanzees.
Sounds like lunchtime around here, Marcy.
Yeah, I know that we do the same thing. These are rescued chimps, and they live at Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest in Clay Ellum, Washington. And our weekday listener, Diana, who sent us that, is lucky because she gets to hear this sound every day. I'm not sure, Diana, are you the lunch server? She says the chimpanzees arrived at the sanctuary in June 2008, and they have been delighting in their food ever since. So that's the sound of chimp delight. I'm sure it's not chimp chow, because that certainly couldn't elicit that kind of response. What I'm not sure if you are listening to anything as interesting as this, but whatever is in the aura of your ears, we'd love to hear about it, and we'd love to hear it. Please record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Coming up on the show, there seems to be a science theme here. We're going to talk about a new Centers for Disease Control study that found an obesity rate drop among low-income children across the country, including here in Washington State. We're going to hear about the national study and what's happening in Washington specifically. Sarah Dickerman talks about food guaranteed really not to make us gain any weight. And our own Amina Al-Sadi talks about the significance of Ramadan, which ended today.
Great. Thank you, Marcy. That's all coming up in the 10 o'clock hour here on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. There's baby animal cuteness in the news today. Two rare Sumatran tiger cubs were born this week at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. That and more of today's news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
A Kentucky town wanted to revive a dilapidated neighborhood. The solution? Practically give those buildings away to artists.
We came here in 2000.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.